the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Filling in for Danielle Leal, here's today's host, Taylor Hillman.
Good Wednesday morning, everybody, and thanks for joining AgNet West and myself for all of today's agriculture news. It's going to be a big day politically, starting with Governor Gavin Newsom's State of the State address later this morning. That's scheduled for 10:30 a.m. Also, there aren't many details yet, but President Trump is in California and is expected to talk water with Congressman Kevin McCarthy in Bakersfield today as well. We, of course, will bring you all of the agriculture news from both of those events later this week. We've got a lot in today's show, starting off with something that both President Trump and Governor Newsom will probably both touch on today, and that is the newly announced structure to voluntary flow agreements. I also have more with the California Avocado Commission and what they found out about an emerging avocado-producing region in Colombia. Brian German will join us in a few minutes with good news for prune producers this year, information on the upcoming California Citrus Mutual Annual Citrus Showcase, and an eyebrow-raising study that is looking into CBD effects on livestock. Lots of information today, so let's get right to the headlines. California's Ag Secretary says it's time to stop pinning environmentalists against agriculture. California's Secretary of Agriculture, Karen Ross, says the framework announced by Governor Newsom on variable flows is the first step in getting environmentalists and producers on the same page to protect the state's water.
Absolutely. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And I really give a lot of credit to farmers and landowners and some of the conservation groups that actually started partnering a decade or more ago. And, you know, it's easy to say, look what the rice growers did for the birds. Well, their commitment is, let's do for the fish what we've done for the birds. But that's taken off. If you look at people who are doing all the great habitat planting for monarch butterfly, or you look at the wildlife corridors that the wine industry has been very conscientious about the things that they do. We've done those in partnership with conservation organizations, and the power of that, there's not enough public dollars in the world to accomplish what landowners and farmers who care about this land so deeply and know it so well can accomplish. So I think we're just at a new era of creating. That doesn't mean everything's going to be all rosy. It doesn't mean everybody's going to be there. But I think we've reached a critical mass to be able to say, doing this together, we can get better results.
Ross said sometimes partnerships need conversation starters to help the two sides work together.
Yeah, and if you look at some of the great conservation programs and the farm bills in recent years, they've evolved to not only provide incentive dollars to the farmers, but fund like regional scale watershed type approaches on some of this work. We fund a lot of demonstration projects as a way to bring partners together, and then providing the technical assistance so farmers know what are the best practices for doing this and still maintain my productivity.
Colombia is well suited to become a major producer of avocados.
They have plenty of land available. They have essentially an ideal climate, you know, not too hot, not too cold, abundant rainfall. But along with that comes some challenges as well.
That's California Avocado Commission Director of Research Tim Spann, who recently visited Colombia and got a chance to see the avocado industry.
They told us they can have avocados 11 months of the year. Wow. So they have kind of two peaks to their season, but 11 months.
Spann said aside from the mostly favorable growing conditions, their location is also a benefit.
They're right down at the base of Central America, and so they have access to both the Pacific Ocean with ports, and they have ports on the Caribbean Ocean as well. So they can send product to Asia, they can send it to Europe, and they can send it to North America very easily.
Spann added that recent changes in Colombia could add support to the growing industry.
There's a lot of really good companies down there. They've, they have been involved in other industries like the cut flower industry that they've become the world leader in. So they definitely have the experience and the knowledge in agriculture to dominate an industry if they put their mind to it. And with the recent political stabilization of the country, I think they have a lot of potential. Give them 10, 20 years and they're going to be a force to contend with.
Now here's Brian German with good news for prune producers.
California prune growers appear to be set for a strong year in 2020. Executive Director of the California Prune Board and Prune Marketing Committee, Don Zay, said that this year's crop is a good one.
We think somewhere between 90 and 95,000 short tons. It's good. I mean, you know, yields per acre were decent, and the most important part is that it is right in the wheelhouse of our California premium positioning. Larger prunes, sweeter prunes than not, certainly, and it is a differentiator between us and everybody else in the market around the world. So when people buy prunes, they have a few choices, and they know if they get California prunes, they're going to get larger and sweeter prunes, and that's what we're known for. So the sizing was good. Growers took it very seriously to make sure they shake within their crops to create those better sizes. So the weather was good. We had some water, and it was exactly the crop we needed. So all things are good there.
While a trade trip to China needed to be postponed, industry members will be heading to Japan soon to reinforce that relationship with such a significant market.
For a long, long time, Japan as an individual country has been our top market, and we have 97%, I think, market share at this point. So it is an important market for us. So no matter how fancy you can get in marketing, that communication face-to-face is so important, and that's what we're doing.
For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Remember to subscribe to the podcast to get updates on the latest episodes. You can follow AgNet West online at agnetwest.com and on social media. Remember to like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also get weekly AgNet West headlines right to your email inbox. Go to agnetwest.com to sign up for the e-newsletter. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City News Day. More agriculture news for you now.
Giving CBD to horses to treat anxiety or arthritis has become substantially more popular since the legalization of industrial hemp in the 2018 Farm Bill. But does the practice truly achieve the desired results? Researchers at Tarleton State University's Equine Center are working on determining the efficacy of giving CBD to horses. The project is looking to quantify how CBD affects inflammation, stress, and stereotypical negative behaviors in horses. The research team is providing different types of CBD products to horses involved in the trial, such as pellets or oils. The horses will be observed for any physiological effects that result from the CBD through measuring heart rate and cortisol levels. The team will also be documenting any effect on common obsessive-compulsive behaviors such as cribbing. Results from the research are expected to be published sometime next year. California Citrus Mutual's annual Citrus Showcase is coming up in a few weeks in Visalia. California Citrus Mutual is hosting its annual Citrus Showcase on Thursday, March 5th at the Visalia Convention Center. President and CEO Casey Creamer highlighted some of the speakers who are scheduled to be presenting and some of the topics that will be addressed during the event.
Our first workshop starts at 9 o'clock. We've got some of our top marketers in. One of the biggest concerns we have in the citrus industry is with the market right now. We've got deflated pricing, especially in navels. That's mainly due to situation in China right now. So we've got President CEO of Sunkist, we got the President CEO of Sun Pacific, General Manager of Booth Ranches, and the President CEO of Wonderful Company. And we're going to do a panel session about the market, what's happening, how much is China affecting, what are some of the other trends that we're seeing in the industry. So really prepare growers and get them real-time information on what's happening in the market, which is incredibly important. Later on in the program, you know, labor is a big concern, H2A. We've got Mike Sackey, who's our labor attorney. It's been in this game for a long time, along with Fresh Harvest, that's H2A contractor. So really talk about the issues with labor force and help growers prepare for what's coming upcoming there.
For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German.
Well, in today's livestock news, during the recent cattle industry convention, I was able to talk with Caitlin Glover, the new executive director of the Public Lands Council and executive director of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association's Natural Resources. We discussed the various issues affecting producers here in the West and across the country.
We have once in a generation, once in a lifetime opportunities on the policy side. The administration has proposed changes to the National Environmental Policy Act that really are going to change the foundation and the way the public interacts with that particular act. So NEPA underpins everything that we do on public lands, but it also affects a lot of the enterprises that are on private land as well. So improving the act, making it more user-friendly, both for people applying for permits and for the administration, it's a good governance issue to make the act work better. Also, the BLM just announced a scoping process to begin the process to revise their grazing regulations. This is something that we have been hoping for at least 20 years. My math isn't super great, but this, again, is a once-in-a-generational opportunity to improve grazing regulations for public lands producers.
Issues don't go away, do they? I mean, producers are constantly finding something, environmental groups, activist groups, always coming up with something they have to defend their rights for, don't they?
You're exactly right. So it is both a blessing and a curse that some of these fights are fights that we've had and we will continue to have long into the future. It's always a little bit of an adventure to go back into the archives to see the challenges that producers faced 50, 100, 150 years ago. And we're still facing many of those market challenges, public perception challenges, but there are added layers now. And so we have to figure out in that regulatory and policy layering effect on public lands, we just have to make sure that it's workable, because everybody needs the food and fiber that we facilitate for them.
Now, we've talked a lot about Western producers, but there are issues that spill all the way across the country for you, too, from time to time.
You're exactly right. And so for me, there are two main buckets of impacts. And this is why the Public Lands Council works so well with NCBA, but that's why the federal lands policy for NCBA is so important. A significant portion of cattle and of sheep in this country spend some time on public lands. For cattle, I think it hovers about 40%, nearly half of sheep in this country. So public lands have a pretty big impact, and access is incredibly important for our industry stability. But then there's the policy side as well. So Western producers have a long history and a deep well of experience with NEPA, with the Endangered Species Act, with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and in a number of other federal policies that they've had to figure out how to navigate. We're seeing more regulatory impacts, more impacts on private lands from endangered species and from birds that are migrating from Canada to Mexico. And so using the expertise of these public lands ranchers and affiliates, it's to the benefit of producers nationwide.
Again, that was PLC and NCBA's Caitlin Glover. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Remember to subscribe to the podcast to get updates on the latest episodes. You can follow AgNet West online at agnetwest.com and on social media. Remember to like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also get weekly AgNet West headlines right to your email inbox. Go to agnetwest.com to sign up for the e-newsletter. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's interview segment, we have another episode of the Voices of the Valleys podcast. Today's episode is a little bit different as Western Growers CIT Director Dennis Donahue moves to the other side of the mic and tells us about Ag Tech Ed happening at an event coming up in March.
Welcome to Voices of the Valleys, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you today by Harvestport, an innovation hub and marketplace for better agricultural products, practices, and ideas. Find out more at harvestport.com. Now, here's your Voices of the Valleys host, Director of Western Growers Center for Innovation and Technology, Dennis Donahue.
Welcome to another episode of Voices of the Valleys. Don't change your channel. This is not Dennis Donahue. However, I do have Dennis here with me. He is actually the person that's going to be interviewed today. We're going to be talking about the 7th Annual Salinas Valley Ag Tech Summit. It's something that we've gone to before. Dennis, Western Growers Center for Innovation and Technology is partnering with the event this year. Let's just start very brief.
Tell me about the Salinas Valley Ag Tech Summit, what it is. It's been around for a little while. It's getting established.
It has. I think this will be the sixth or seventh annual. But what I've always found important and unique about this particular event is a lot of these events take place in metropolitan areas or can be a little pricey. And I think this is the most democratic of them all in terms of accessibility. But it's also drawn really typically a different audience. It does get a lot of educators already, but it gets ag ops, it gets crop advisors, it gets equipment dealers. So it really basically is an event if you want to get close to the farm. And I think that's important because when we think about ag tech, a lot of that activity is really focused on production agriculture. And so, you know, to me, this is really kind of in a good way, where the rubber meets the road.
It's the Hartnell College event. They're the ones who put it on. It's there at the college. It is March 17th and 18th. Like I mentioned, you guys are helping with it this year. You're partnering with it. What are you guys going to be doing with the event this year?
Well, we're going to change it up with a different focus. If you look at a lot of the ag tech events, there's a common narrative of why innovation is necessary, whether you're talking about you've got a innovation and technology are going to be important looking down the road in terms of feeding a growing world population. Obviously, folks are attentive to climate change related issues and all that entails and potential impacts on production agriculture. I think everyone's very, very clear on the challenges of labor in terms of rising cost and availability. And the impact of increasing regulation and societal interest in food production. So we know that's the reason to innovate. But technology in a vacuum is potentially a very good thing. But the reality is, all this technology is going to require a new kind of workforce. So one of the things when you've been around this space that you often hear is there are adoption challenges, there are personnel challenges. So we thought this was a perfect spot to kind of jump in and begin to introduce, not only here but on an ongoing basis throughout the WGA network, the idea of essentially kind of recasting ag tech as ag tech ed, in the sense that we have to talk about the challenges are real. The technology players are the technology players, and whoever they may be today, tomorrow. But what they all have in common is a challenge to find the right kind of workforce. So we want them to, we'll grant the background, but we want them to say, in order to deploy this type of technology, these are the type of skills that we're looking for. So if you look at the flow of the programming, there's a certain rationale and continuity to it. There's a VIP reception the night before to kick it off on St. Patrick's Day. So Dr. Shia, the new president of Hartnell, who has a very strong background in workforce development, so one of the key components of tomorrow's workforce is how do you take today's workforce and train up? We know colleges, particularly community colleges, when it comes to the production side of things, are important in terms of attracting tomorrow's employees, the next generation. And then that leads to a serious conversation of how do you prepare for that in terms of curriculum, teacher preparation, because, you know, there's a lot of focus on students, as there should be, but frankly, teacher preparation is equally important. So we just thought this was a great place to say, hey, let's take this event, plant this flag as we kind of go on to the next phases of ag tech. So we think it's an important event from that standpoint.
Yeah, so I just had an interesting conversation with CDFA Secretary Karen Ross, right, who hates the word artificial intelligence.
Right.
And it's because what we're talking about in technology and helping growers is going to take intelligence, right, from the worker to use. So right now, technology is at a helping the current worker. So you're right. We need to focus on education for those workers.
Right, yeah. So again, if you kind of go with the flow of the event, you know, after Dr. Shia talks, and then, and we're going to have a little fun the night before the 18th. We're going to put a panel of Irish ag entrepreneurs.
Well, it's St. Patrick's Day.
Well, it is, and I've vetted all their accents. They will be appropriate, but it also speaks to the fact this is a global game, ag tech, and you know your solutions, your workforce, the entire world will be in play. Even for California agriculture, as it always has been, you know, whether it's on the production side, on the sales side, and ag tech's going to be no different. So we'll kind of underscore that in a fun way with the Irish on the 17th.
Well, definitely. I mean, so it's, you know, there may be an opportunity there. You know, the United States is a little bit more slower to adopt things. So I think if these other regions are seeing things that they're starting to use, US might be able to get some education ahead of the curve before things even come here, which might be beneficial.
Well, you know, our mission at the Innovation Center is the rapid commercialization of solutions for our member base and our grower base. And the reality is other parts of the world have had to face some of these challenges ahead of us. So we would be remiss if we didn't take advantage of that and make our membership base aware of that. And then the other element of all this, and you know, there's interest, you know, when you look at the whole ag tech thing, folks come at it from a lot of different ways, whether as an investor, as an entrepreneur. We're representing the growers, you know, which are fundamentally represents the customer lane. You know, there's the economic development aspect. When I was a mayor, we obviously were thinking about economic development for Salinas. And what we have found out, even on the global side, folks, even if they come from other parts of the world, they will localize their presence and hire locally and that sort of thing. So these things tend to be a win-win.
Thanks for listening to the Voices of the Valleys podcast, brought to you today by Harvestport, an innovation hub and marketplace for better agricultural products, practices, and ideas. Find out more at harvestport.com.
Again, this is just a portion of the Voices of the Valleys podcast. You can listen to the whole episode by searching Voices of the Valley in your favorite podcasting app. We'll be back after the break.
You're listening to Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. Remember to subscribe to the podcast to get updates on the latest episodes. You can follow Agnet West online at agnetwest.com and on social media. Remember to like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also get weekly Agnet West headlines right to your email inbox. Go to agnetwest.com to sign up for the e-newsletter. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. Import and export numbers for U.S. agriculture are approaching a historic event. The amount of agriculture sent out to foreign markets has always exceeded the number of ag products the United States has purchased from other countries. That statement is still true, but it's getting close.
That's historic, and I think it has a lot to do with the recent trade wars and probably provided some incentive to get that China deal phase one done.
Bryant Christie President James Christie said those import and export numbers have never been equal. The recent trade agreements should help those export numbers again, but other relationships also need work, and a few countries are historically hard to deal with.
Absolutely. Very difficult to do business with the European Union and Japan, particularly on ag. Happy about the new Japan deal. Hopefully that'll help Japan or work there. And hopefully we get a free trade agreement with the European Union that includes ag soon.
There's always been chatter around making the choice to implant cattle. Bob Cervera has more.
There has always been chatter around making the choice to implant cattle. Robbie Pritchard, a longtime South Dakota State University ruminant nutritionist who's known for his expertise in feedlot nutrition and management, says, quote, "Implants represent a tool that really fit the template of precision ag.
Implanted versus non-implanted, there would be in a production lifetime production system about 175 pounds difference in the weight of the steer when they're finished. It becomes important to me economically because that's 175 pounds more beef sold per cow."
Pritchard says best practices advise administering implants while the calf is on the cow, again during the backgrounding phase, and finally during the finishing phase.
If you only administer one and you do it early in their life, an implant essentially convinces the steer they ought to be a little bit larger framed. And when they go away, so does that influence, and they will go back to being the frame size they were. So you lose all of the benefit that you had. So if you're only going to use one, you would want to use it near the end when the animal's most predisposed to putting on excess fat.
Try selling a BMW to someone who's looking for a Chevrolet. In theory, it sounds ideal, but chances are you don't have an endless supply sitting around. The same is true for cattle. Superior genetics and phenotypes are ideal, but they're less common than the norm.
I put together numbers in a scenario that would look least favorable to using implants, where spreads were extremely wide for primes and the choice select discount was extremely wide, and I used a really inexpensive feed cost. And at the end, the non-implanted steer needs a base carcass price premium of $11 a hundredweight. They need that in addition to the bonuses they got for having more primes and fewer select.
Subscribe to the American Angus Association's YouTube channel, Angus TV, for more news and education. I'm Bob Cervera.
Thanks again for joining AgNet West for all of your agriculture news this morning. A reminder that Governor Newsom will deliver California's State of the State address at 10:30 this morning, and President Trump will be talking about water issues in California.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgNetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgNetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City News Day by AgNet West.